program tonight, you all know. And Sandra Wilson is going to show her pictures and tell her experiences protecting school children in a small town in Hebron of the West Bank. A lot of you know Cassandra very well, but for those of you who might not, let me just tell you, she's an ordinary person like all the rest of us. Cassandra, she runs a Catholic worker house. She is a carpenter 6 days a week, 10 hours a day. She has two grown children who are beautiful. And then she does things like going with the peacemakers to Hebron once in a while. So give her a big hand.
Thank you all so much for taking the time to come and hear about this. This is like, I know all of you personally, and I know all of you are such busy people, and so I really, really appreciate this, because this, the whole proposition of traveling somewhere, you know, halfway around the globe, just to, like, just be there for a couple of months, and then coming home again, it's so discombobulating to me. It's not something that I didn't grow up doing that kind of stuff, and the whole concept that it works, that just to go someplace and learn about a problem and come back, like, does that actually accomplish anything, you know? It's really a quandary for me, and so that it adds to my, like, huge appreciation of you just bothering to take the time to let the information about these particular people into your lives. So I really, really appreciate it. Thank you. So these slides that I have are all from the village of Tuwani, which is in the southern end of the West Bank. It's in an area that's between a settler-only road and the bottom of the West Bank and the green line of the wall, which goes through around the bottom. So it's an area that's in some ways kind of cut off because it has access only by crossing that road. And it's an area that Israel would really like to take all of that land for a large military base that's already there that they would like to expand. So for a number of reasons, it's a spot that's under a lot of contention. Tuwani itself is a village that's 900 to 1,000 years old. People can trace their own, she just winked, didn't she? Their own family history back that far, which I find just so amazing. There has now, though, been a settlement built quite near it, and that's the event that has occasioned Christian Peacemaker Team's presence in the area. Largely because kids need to walk very near the settlement to get to school. So the area is the traditionally shepherding and dryland agriculture. So it very carefully supported kind of the number of people that were there. Tuwani is about 200 people. There are about another few families living in the small village of Tuba and several other similarly small villages clustered around that area. And all of this has been greatly changed by the event of settlers moving into the area. There are currently about 450,000 settlers in the West Bank, and about 20% of those settlers are very ideologically motivated and very, very much want to see the Palestinians in this particular area gone, just really removed from the area. And so that's the situation that the village of Tuwani faces, is that those are the settlers that live in the settlement and the outposts that are near them. So I say this to sort of make it clear that this is The dilemmas that the people in this village face from the settlers are not probably representative of settlers throughout Israel, and they're certainly not representative of Israelis as a whole, but they are the daily events of this village, and they are the and this is the mindset of the settlers that these people are interacting with.
I wonder if we should turn the lights off. I think the images would be clear.
Second switch.
Yeah.
Oh, that. Oh, yes. Do you leave the door open or close it?
Oh, it's fine.
It's okay.
So the settler activity began in the area around the 20 in 1980 when a group of Israelis helped by Christian Zionists from the United States planted a lot of pine trees on a hill near Tuwani. And they removed all the trees in order to do that. And yeah, there's Reuben. Mm-hmm.
Removed all the trees.
And planted this dense grove of pine trees on a hill between Tuwani and the small village of Touba. Palestinians had built a road between Tuwani and Touba, which is the only road access to the village of Touba. Just because of the topography of the area, it's the only space where you could, it's just too hilly otherwise. So the settlement is built right near that road and has really limited the ability of people in Touba to get to Tuwani or anywhere else. So in 1984, settlers then came back after these trees had grown for a while. Settlers came back to the area and began construction of the Mullen settlement. And since that time, since 1984, settler attacks on Palestinians in that area have sort of gradually continued to rise. And the settlement has taken more and more Palestinian land. At this point, the settlement controls about 400 acres. And most of that land was privately owned, individually owned land. Like, it wasn't just general Palestinian land, it was owned by specific families and farmed. So that's been a terrible loss to families from the village.
Did they sell it, or it was just
no,
taken?
No, they just took it.
Was there any compensation at all?
No.
How did they take it?
Through violence. At that time, there were several smaller hamlets of the hamlets of Sorora and Humra and Faluba, where people had lived for a very, very long time, like a couple families to each. And this is, I know it sounds so tiny, but people are spread out like that because the land will only support so many sheep, and it takes so many sheep to support a family. And so so that it's the need to just not overpopulate and not overgraze that area. So those tiny hamlets are all abandoned now because settlers attacked people so persistently and so caused so much fear that people were forced to leave. So some of those families moved into Tuwani. Some of them moved to the town of Yatta, which was a little farther away. And once they had left, there is no going back because it's just really impossible to get your land back once that happened. So it's a combination of people being afraid to sleep, afraid to have their kids out, afraid to be out shepherding, afraid to be out on a donkey, afraid to garden, afraid to go back and forth from those villages to Tuwani and back, and then the inability to actually use their land. They weren't able to safely put crops in or safely harvest crops. And so those smaller villages have wound up abandoned. And then, as if this was not enough, the settlement of Mullen would have been, I think, disruptive enough to this area. But villagers in Tuwani, a lot of people really believed initially when the Mullen settlement started that it would not be a terrible problem, that the settlement would be there and those people would live there and this would be all right. But the settlers then began to construct an outpost, and the outposts in Israel are illegal even under Israeli law. Both the outposts and the settlements are illegal under international law, but the outposts are also illegal under Israeli law. It's kind of as if Fitchburg decided that it just wanted a whole bunch of land in Stoughton, and they just went and started. They brought a bunch of mobile homes and they parked them there and declared that was now part of Fitchburg. And that's about the process, the extent of negotiation or compensation or process around this. And then they have then set about making it impossible for anyone else to also use that land. So these have all been kids who live in Tuwani and Tuba. This young woman is a girl who walks every day from Tuba to go to school in Tuwani. And it's that effort to keep the kids from Tuba going to school in Tuwani that occasioned, that caused international accompaniment to come to this area. Sort of elders from both villages approached Christian peacemaker teams and an Italian accompaniment group called Operation Dove about the possibility of walking kids back and forth. Because the kids, yes, this picture is in here because it's sort of the general impression that it's never winter over there, but I usually get there in like mid to late February, and it snows. It doesn't, like this snow didn't last very long, but it does snow.
She had a question.
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
If they didn't have accompanists, would they not go to school? Would it just be very dangerous for them to go to school?
I'm not sure really what would be happening there. You know, there aren't all that many instances of international accompaniment. I mean, even in the world, nonviolent accompaniment is not a real common thing. And so I guess there's not really much of a body of knowledge on how it works or how it doesn't work or how I think that in this particular instance it is making a big difference, but that's not due so much to the accompaniment. It's due to the determination and the commitment of all of the adults involved and also all of their kids. So I think that probably they would be finding a way to make this work regardless, but this is the way that they've found. So.
Or do they feel that it makes it safer if the people know you're there?
It definitely makes it safe.
Cassandra, could you talk a little bit about the difference between how the settlers have so much power, maybe about who's armed and who isn't armed and how all that works?
Okay, so then this, again, my disclaimer that I have been only to this one spot, and this is, I don't know how representative this is of any place else, but I have never met an armed Palestinian, and I have never witnessed an act of violence on the part of a Palestinian. Most of the Israelis I've met have been armed, and when I've been scared there, it's Israelis that have frightened me. It's not, he's visiting us in the yard of the house that Tuwani built for CBT and Operation Dove. It's you can see the corner of the house in the back is built out of that concrete block. He's modeling his footwear there. He's waiting for us to go get the duct tape. I think that what kind of gives these particular settlers the power that they do have is not just the fact that Israel is well funded. It's not just the fact that they have weapons. It's not just the fact that they're dealing with a populace that has chosen nonviolence and has made a really firm commitment not to respond violently. What really gives them the power that they hold to frighten people is the fact that they are not intimidated by the concept of causing bodily harm to people. They just, I live sort of a protected life in general. You know, I have not spent a lot of time around people who don't have a problem with beating the crap out of you. This is a foreign concept to me. And these settlers don't have a problem with that. And I think it's my personal belief that they have to kind of rev themselves up into that state, because I've occasionally come upon one or two settlers out there, you know, when I've been out with shepherds or out, you know, out with kids out in those fields, and they'll be startled and they don't immediately react violently, but they are quite willing to get themselves wound up into a state where they go out the door and their whole intent as they're going out their door is to hurt someone. And I mean, I know this is part of human beings, you know, we hurt each other. But I personally have not ever in any other instance in my life witnessed that level of comfort with hurting someone. And not just from afar, but close up and personal. They're willing to break someone's arm, or it just, so I think that's some kind of boundary in interpersonal behavior that they've crossed, that yes, has given them some power. So this is, let's see, the spot.
Is the Israeli military ever present, and they just allow it to happen?
Yeah, there actually are soldiers who accompany the kids now, and their presence has not it makes a difference, but hasn't solved the problem, I guess.
So you're saying it's not
there a
sanctioned.
Zoom?
I think she's
the violence is not sanctioned.
Is there a napkin under here?
Not just so this is a I won't use a lot of time with this, but this is a map of the West Bank. You don't need to see anything small for me to get across what I want to say about is that this is the West Bank. It sits within Israel, but this is just the West Bank. You can see out there that gray area over there is Tel Aviv, and Israel extends down there. Gaza is down off the map. It's like down below that Wilf sign down there along the floor. So this is just the West Bank, which we have the general impression is Palestinian, right? That's just what most of us would probably, like, from our media, that would be our impression. Actually, all of the blue areas there are Israeli, owned, controlled by Israel, and inhabited by Israelis. And the dark blue areas are settlements. All those dark blue areas are the settlements that house the 450,000 settlers that live inside the West Bank. The blue, long blue strip along the right-hand side sits above the major aquifer. So all of that water is basically controlled by Israeli settlers. Palestinians live in the areas that are brown shaded are Palestinian, and the dark brown areas are areas that actually have some population in them. A lot of that land is, there's no water in it at all, and so it's not very inhabitable for, like, dense population. So you can see how fractured up that brown area is. It's not like it's a contiguous, you can't get from point A to point B without going, you know, here and there all over the place. And that's, I just think that this is really an underlying misunderstanding on our part of like a really basic fact of what life is like there, that it's so fractured up like that.
What's the brown area in the Sea of Blue?
Those are some Bedouin communities that are still there. So, but all of this used to be Palestinian. All of Israel used to be inhabited by Palestinians. And at the point where these lines around the outside there, the outer one is the green line,
which was the original agreement for where that line would be. The red line is where the wall is actually being constructed, so that you can see it's come in quite a lot. And the purple line is wall that has not yet been constructed. So a lot of what's happened is that settlements have been built, and then the wall has been built around them to. So if you're interested in looking at this, these maps are available online, and the organization is Bet Selim. Now, I don't know why I did that, but hopefully we'll just.
What is the white space that's between the brown and the light blue?
The white space is just nobody's living there. And generally that's because that land is just not inhabited. Anyway, if you want to look at them more, if you go to Bet Selim's website, you can look closer or I'm happy to give you a map. So enough time. Okay, so now this is the very bottom end of that map. And inside that red area there, you can see Tuba at the top. And Tuani is kind of over, like, between the point of that red thing and that black line. And then that road that runs between there is 317 is like a lot of roads that crisscross the West Bank, is a settler-only road. Palestinians are not allowed to use that road. And it happens to run, it effectively cuts off this entire area. That the green line there is down at the bottom there. And the purple line, which is where the separation barrier is actually being built. So the area that's enclosed by red is an area that Israel very much would like to have complete control of. There's a big military base at Jimba, which is down toward the lower left-hand point there. A huge military base. I mean, it's like lots of training exercises. Helicopters fly out of there. The Air Force uses it. They drop ordnance there. And so all of these tiny villages, all of the black dots that you see within that red space there are Palestinian villages that, in my opinion, are really sort of slated for destruction. They're just like, they would really like those people not to be there. You can see that Maon is the blue area right above that red boundary there, right next to Atwani. So this too, if you're curious and want to look at it more.
Where's Tuwani? I see Atwani's here.
Yeah,
right.
And that's Maon.
Where's
right, the right from
Tuba is to the right.
Inside the
is
red.
Yeah.
Keep going. Right.
You have to walk that far?
Right. Well, this is pretty blown up here.
Oh.
But that's about a half-hour walk from Tuba to Tuani.
Wow.
And so you can see it goes right through that. The most direct route goes right through the Maon settlement.
Right.
And that is about the route that the two villages had built a road. And now there is a big industrial chicken barn right on that road. There is no using the road. So, and the, after accompaniment started in, there's the village of Tuani. It's amazing to me how sweet and peaceful these villages look like. They're almost camouflaged. You know, you hardly see them. They're so set into those hills. Very pretty. And it briefly in the spring looks like that, very green. Oops, sorry. These are a couple of the areas that were abandoned in the early 90s, and it's just amazing to me that, like, these houses, don't they look like they were abandoned, you know, somewhere in the previous century? But
bunkers.
Yeah. I mean, there are people living in Tuani, my age, who were born in these homes. And the red roofs there are the settlement of Maon. And then to the right of them are the trees that were planted. And that inside those trees is the outpost. And the road Tuba, the picture is taken from in Tuwani, and Tuba is on the other side of those trees, mm-hmm. and the road skirts the edge of the trees. Mm-hmm. And so given that there are settlers living in the red roofed houses and settlers living in the trees, there's not much in the way of a safe way for kids to walk through there. The house in the foreground is, there are 28 kids live in that sort of extended family dwelling there, and all of their associated adults. That's the home belongs to the Rabai family, and they lost the most land. Their land extended up into where the red-roofed houses are. They had olive trees growing up in there and farmed that land before the 70s. They have also experienced the most, because they're on the edge there, more harassment from settlers and also from soldiers. They've had windows broken at night when people have been sleeping in those rooms, glasses falling into the house, and very often settlers just coming into the yard. So this is all small and close together. It's kind of it's intimate in every imaginable way. The settlement is just like right on top of the village, and the village is small. It's four big families. Everybody there knows each other completely. And then added to that is the concept of having Westerners come and live permanently in this village it's amazing to me that all of this works. There's a guy from the Red Cross in this area that's doing his doctoral dissertation on the impact of Westerners on the village of Tuwani, and it's it's taking him a long time to write it, but I'm really curious to read it when he's done. So you can see here the whole outpost area is where the rainbow is ending there, right where those trees are. And in the foreground are the homes at the edge of the village.
What's an outpost as opposed to a settlement?
Like a suburb.
Is it trailers?
You know, we don't know because they're in those trees and no one's ever been in those trees, so I don't know.
They're like
I don't know what they've got.
They're like small arm camps.
Are living there, and they want to probably turn it into a settlement at some point because they see more of
that. Right.
Okay, right.
Well, what's happening in this instance is that it means that, you know, they kind of leapfrogged out there. They went across the road and took land in these trees. Right.
Advanced
scholars. Yeah. Kind of, yeah. But it also results then in them controlling all of the land in between because it's now so difficult to pass through there. So it's a way of grabbing land, really. Also and this is not the only settlement outpost situation in this area. Like within, you know, an hour's walk of the village of Tuwani, there are four or five settlements, and a number of those have also an outpost. And so those outposts in that area in general seem to be populated by younger settlers, and part of their mentality is that they, like their parents, did this great and wonderful and courageous thing and went out and took land for Israel by living in a settlement. And then they got microwaves and they got TVs and they got, like, Blockbuster Video has huge contracts in these settlements, the videos to keep everybody happy, you know, and they've got, so there's, it's not roughing it anymore, if indeed it ever was. So there's a segment of the young male population that would like an adventure. And they have got their hands on horses and ATVs, and there are a lot of who populates those settlements. It's kind of like frat boy sort of. And they don't, as far as, I don't think that they work in general. A number of people who live in the Molon settlement I mean, this is the settlers can get from the Mullen settlement to Jerusalem in 20 minutes on a bus. Or the Palestinians can take 4 or 5 hours to get from Jerusalem there. You have to take you don't go in anything like a straight line. You go all over the place, and you know, you'll be in a bus that does one little section of it, and then there's a checkpoint, and that bus only has a permit to go there, and then another taxi has a permit to do this piece, and then you have to go through Hebron, and you have to go upside down and around the edge to do that, and it takes forever. But people who live in Maon have a part of the logic of living there as a settler is this, it's a good real estate deal. They're very well supported.
But if the young men aren't working, who's supporting them?
Yeah, I just think they have very little in the way of expenses.
We are.
13 million dollars a day.
Right, but do they get payments from the government?
Sure.
Or their parents, maybe?
I don't really know.
Yeah, they get subsidies from the Israeli government. And from Zionist organizations in the United States.
Yeah, that's probably right, yeah.
Subsidies. So this is the road that connects Tuwani and all of those villages that you saw in that red area to the town of Yatta to the north. You can see up to the right the red-roofed houses, and so this is taken standing on the settler-only road through 17, and you can see that this road at the time of this picture has been blocked with these boulders. This road is continually being blocked and unblocked and blocked and unblocked. This particular job was done by Israeli military vehicles, bulldozers that were used to move those boulders into place. It will get cleared by villagers, sometimes cleared with some negotiation with Israeli authorities, and then reblocked by settlers who will come and just do this again, roll the rocks in. At one point, there was a concrete barrier, like a low wall, built straight across it. And villagers actually sued and were able to get that particular barrier removed. But it's a very much of an ongoing, thing. And the road is it's as if it's like blocking off Johnson Street, Gorham Street, John Nolan Drive, and you know, like it's the only, it creates complete isolation for these villages. This is the only route that people have to get to Yatta or Hebron to the north. And that's the only, for medical care or any kind of commerce, everything is up there. These are the teachers who have come from Yatta in the morning, and they're having to walk over this rubble pile to get into Tuwani. They came from Yatta in that white van, which is a taxi van, you know, which is not allowed to go and can't go any further, and so has dropped them off, and they're having to walk up into Tuwani through this rubble. These are this is the low barrier wall. This section of the low barrier wall has actually been removed right now, but people feel that it's very likely that it will be reconstructed. But there's often a checkpoint at that point, so this is a soldier stopping that.
So he's not allowed on the 317.
He's just trying to cross it.
I see.
It's a perpendicular, like a four-way. Mm-hmm. So people are trying to get farm goods or crops or anything back and forth from Yatta. Will be stopped, and because the roads are so bad, the road that runs from Yatta and goes through Tuwani into those villages to the south was built in 1946 by Jordan, and it has not had anything done to it in a positive way since then. So it's in really rough shape. So tractors are not just for farming, but they're really the only way to get on a lot of this road. This was an action that was done at one point during the villages. The villages had come together to protest the construction of that low barrier wall. This man who's being arrested is a leader of the nonviolence there, and has been his family very instrumental in keeping the kids going back and forth. these big square blocks that often have been brought by the military and set in that road to block it. And this was a day on which the village had decided to move both those blocks, and often also the military would just create a big earth mound across there. And this was, you know, here, like, we find ourselves participating in a nonviolence movement in this country where we're often looking for a good opportunity to do a, you know, to do an action that gets a point across. And these people just, like, live in that. Like, that's the fishbowl that they swim in all the time. So this is these dirt piles had been set in this road by bulldozers, and people had showed up this day with hand tools to move all that dirt. And under the eye of a lot of military, all kinds of weaponry around, and they've got their kids out there moving that dirt. And this is the women had taken on a couple of those big concrete blocks and kind of dug out an area down below the block so they could tip the block down into there and move it out of there. And this is the mother of the man that we saw arrested at a previous demonstration. You can see behind there the three women that are sitting down, and this. Often in these kind of situations, you'll see the elder women, like, they're actually younger than me, but they have this exalted status of being the older women. Will just sit, and it's extremely calming. And this was the entire day was a very, very tense situation, like 12 hours of a tense situation, and these women will just sit in the middle of it and create kind of a little calm spot in the middle of whatever else is going on.
What's their definition of elder?
Yeah, I'm pretty old there.
I was amazed how they don't seem to get dirty doing that. All those beautiful clothes and they weren't dirty.
Yeah, it's a dry dirt. So they got it cleared out of there. That tractor with the cow on it was the first vehicle to go through, and they had timed this so that at noon, it's the entire village there.
That's it.
Wow. So this is a young woman whose name was Marifat. She's 12. She was a really smart, vibrant young woman, and she lived in Tuwani. She had appendicitis, and her family was unable to get her on that road out of there to a hospital, and she died in the car on that road. And her family members were in a lot of the pictures that we've just seen. So now this is looking towards the village of Tuba. This is kind of the terrain that the kids walk through to get to school, and also those people that are accompanying them try to get into. In 1984, in 2004, when accompaniment started, there were previous to that, there had been a number of instances when the kids had been beaten badly by settlers on the way. But when an international accompaniment started, when the village decided to ask for that, there were internationals beaten. And at that, of course, got a lot of attention and resulted in a couple members of the Israeli Knesset saying, this is embarrassing and appalling that these kids are being beaten up on their way to school. And so they drafted an order and got this passed through the Knesset requiring the military to escort the kids, the Israeli military to escort the kids, so that there wouldn't be those type of international incidents. So since that time, since 2004, the military has been involved with doing this escort of the kids through this area here, where these chicken barns are, with varying degrees of success. The Israeli military has refused to allow internationals to walk along with them. They claim that they won't be safe from the settlers if there are internationals with them. And they also refuse to escort the kids the entire walk. Out of that 30-minute walk, they walk with them for about 10 minutes. So Tuba, looking at these chicken barns here, Tuba is to our right and Tawani to our left. So in the morning, kids come from Tuba, and they have to cross all the way in front of these chicken barns on the outside of this chain link fence, all the way around them to the other side before the escort will meet them. And it's in this, and then coming home in the afternoon, the escort leaves them way on the other side of these chicken barns over to our left. And they have to walk around the outside perimeter of that fence above that rubble pile, all the way around there to get back to Tuba. If parents, a lot of people would think, so why don't these families just walk their own kids to school? You know, what's wrong with them? But if those Palestinian families were to do that, there would be they would be assaulted, without a doubt. And often internationals are assaulted in this area when we try to meet the kids where the escort actually leaves them along. So this is this ongoing since 04. Now, these kids are getting older and older and older as this goes along here. And it's just so amazing to me that tucked away in this little corner, the entire group of actors here is, 200 villagers and whoever, we don't know how many settlers, but a very small number of people, and their persistence in getting the kids around this blockage and to school day after day after day is so amazing. You can see in those trees there, those towers, and this is why I say it's, who knows really what goes on in that outpost, because it's very hard to see into it.
And that's why they planted all those trees, so they'd have cover?
I think so. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think so. So this is the kids coming around the other end of the trees. And the area that they're in used to belong to the Khomeini family, and was olive trees in this area, and now it's been turned into strawberries on either side, and some apricots that the settlers grow and irrigate greatly. And interestingly, Thai workers come in and do most of the work with those settlers. But so the kids, the section of road that the kids are on now is part of the road, the Palestinian road that was built between Tuwani and Tuba, but no adult Palestinian can walk on that road now. The only Palestinians that are able to set foot on that road are these children. And so they're in this position of not only are they trying to get to school, back and forth to school every day, but they are holding that space for their community. And really, a lot more space, because that's the last little bit of hanging on to this road and the last hope that the village of Tuba has of ever regaining access to the rest of the world.
Have the settlers ever tried to attack the children or the military when the military is with the children?
The settlers attack these kids on the average of every 2 weeks.
But
They'll come out of those trees and throw stones, run after them, scream at them, scratch them, steal their backpacks, push them over, grab them, try to drag them back into the trees. They're extremely terrible.
And are some of the settlers, are some of them children that do that to the Palestinians?
They bring their kids with them, so there are kids watching that. And there are, there's a couple of women in particular that are just really, really ferocious. I also saw, they also just come out and, like, scream at people and taunt them. And, kind of along the edge of those trees, I once saw a guy and four kids. It was like they were stepped down. So maybe the oldest kid, the guy was maybe in his 30s, and then maybe a 18, 20-year-old, and then a couple adolescents, and a little kid, maybe a 6 or 7-year-old. And the guy walked these settler kids out there, and then they had a little conversation, and we were there because we were, so one of the the one of the ways in which the military escort is not effective is that they are always, always late. And so internationals will sit down there about where the Jeep is and wait with the kids. And it's a dangerous spot for the kids to wait because they're very vulnerable to the settlers there. And yet if they're not right there, then they can't find the escort and they can't get home. So they have to wait there. So anyway, while we're waiting, this guy brings the four settler kids out there and they mooned these people. They drop their pants. So, well, we think it's funny, but this is not our culture. You know, this is a culture where it's, you know, you don't roll your shirt up above your elbows here, and dropping your pants is just outrageous.
Do you know what kind of settlers these were? Were these one of the ones that are religious extremists? Or?
These are some of those, I guess it's roughly 20% of that 450,000. That are ideologically extreme.
And several are from America, if you want to.
A lot of them are from America. Yeah. As are a lot of these IDF soldiers. Are a lot of them from America.
I read an article, I think it was in the New York Times, saying that there was a lot of Americans who went over there, American Jews, who said things like, "Well, I want to kill people," and that's a place where they can.
This little guy is my personal favorite. Oops, sorry. These are two kids that there is a longer path that takes a couple hours by donkey. This little girl that in the back there was badly beaten early in this walk, before a company started, early in this trouble. And she didn't talk for maybe 3-4 years, didn't speak at all. So they've taken the family donkey and they're about to go home this longer route, about a 4-mile walk. So I gotta hurry up, I'm gonna... You should just stop me if it's time to quit, because that's a chunk of it on the kids and that accompaniment. And then there's some more information on... It's like, so the walk to school is only one aspect of life. It's interrupted here, but if somebody just stop me if it's going on too long. So this is I guess to sort of try to get across how sort of tight together everything is here. The trees, the top line of trees, that's the outpost. You can see the road that disappears up into there. The lower trees are Palestinian olive trees that are. What's left of a large grove that used to run throughout that valley, and settlers have come down and destroyed a lot of those olive trees. This the guy in the red hat there is grazing sheep in those trees, and so that's a daily. They're very close there, always very close, and so there is never for these people a work day that doesn't include the possibility of somebody coming after them with stones and guns and just fury in the midst of their whatever they're doing there. Yep.
Can you speak to how they have embraced nonviolence in this particular community?
The village, yeah. So I don't really know that, because I would like to think that that's being replicated all over the place. It's also the imbalance of power is so extreme that I find it hard to imagine a situation where a village, like there are villages in this kind of situation and worse throughout. And if a Palestinian from Tawani were to walk in public with a weapon, they'd be shot on sight. They would just not live to tell about it. So it's hard for me really to imagine much of an alternative. But what I have seen people exert huge effort in doing is not throwing stones. And you can see this landscape is just stones everywhere, and the settlers use them with great effect. They don't just pick them up in their hands and throw them, but they have these slingshot things that they, you know, whirl around, and I've been hit with stones thrown with those things. It's you think that you've been hit by a meteor, but the things are going, they're like grapefruit size, and they're moving really fast.
They're weapons.
It's the village of Tuwani and Tuba. They made this commitment amongst themselves to continue to send the kids back and forth. And they made the decision to ask for international accompaniment from two organizations which are also committed to nonviolence. And they have, like all of those parties, have that commitment. And it's, in all of these years, never been breached. So this is a shepherd. I talk about this people, part of what international accompaniers do in this situation is go out and sit with shepherds, and it's often they're this age of kids.
How old is he?
Probably like 11, 12. Mm-hmm. And sheep are huge, figure just hugely in people's existence there. They're a major source of food. People eat a lot of lamb. They eat cheese and milk and all kinds of products that are made from sheep and goats. So the ability to graze sheep and goats on their family land is really, really, really important to their being able to stay there. This is the sheep being washed in the spring before they're sheared. And this is the family, the Rabai family, that lives so, you know, closer to the trees and has just been subjected to so much. The sheep really love that. So the wool is important, and I guess it's all of this labor is done completely by hand, very little mechanization, and that's not necessarily by choice. It's just so hard to get anything there. The result is this: she's making butter, and that's basically a sheep turned inside out there. Mm-hmm. And she'll just rock that back and forth until the milk inside. It's like, have you ever made with kids? You know, put whole raw milk in a mason jar and shook it until you get butter. Really, really delicious cheeses and this like yogurt type stuff and but those sheep are just completely used, every piece of those sheep. There's the settlement and the outpost have electricity, but Tuwani and Tuba, the Palestinian villages, have not been allowed to run electricity, and they will never be allowed to connect to Israel's grid. And so you do see, they run a generator for a couple hours every evening, and they collectively buy the gas to run that generator. But they're like, she's not really doing that by hand, by choice. It's just like, if there was the possibility of doing that with electricity, she'd be happy to do it. When I was there in the spring, Tony Blair visited. Tony Blair is like head of the quartet on the Middle East, and his big project there was to get an okay from Israel for the Palestinian Authority to build pylons for an electric lines. And they did get a verbal okay, and the villagers began construction of those pylons, but then within the last month or so, soldiers came in with demolition orders for those pylons and said that no, there was no permit. So
how come you don't see any evidence of the much touted Palestinian Authority police? Or are they just not permitted to operate except in the cities?
Right. They don't have any funding for one thing. You know, there's just this thing. Ever since Hamas won that election, most of Palestine's money has been frozen up in Israeli banks. To some extent, these villages, I mean, part of that equation is that there isn't a lot of crime. There's not a lot of internal strife. Things do get resolved. There are, you know, there are problems in the village, and the village solves those problems. So there's not an awful lot of need for external law enforcement.
Sure.
Yeah, sorry.
Two questions. what exactly is the settler trying to do? Just run them off the land?
Right, right.
But I thought it was people from the outposts that do this, but it's the settlers too.
This man is actually kind of a self-appointed settler security guard. So, and I think that, like, at least this particular settlement and outpost, part of the dynamic there is that the people from the outpost often kind of do the aggressive work of the settlement. That that a lot of settlers within that settlement they're just not about to get out there and mess around like this, you know. Whereas the people in the outpost really thrive on this kind of confrontation. So
the other question I had was, since the outposts are, even by Israeli law, illegal, and this may be a naive question, but is there nothing that the people in the villages can do about the people in the outposts?
Yeah. Well, he's doing it right here. He's insisting on his right to graze those sheep and goats on his private land, right there. In this picture, that's exactly what he's doing. And so just trying to hang on to what they have is a real daily struggle. If it's one of the roles of international accompaniment there is documenting Palestinian use of land, and if Palestinians can't prove that they've been using agricultural land, they can lose it. If they can't prove use of it within 5 years, it can be taken from them. And if they can't produce deeds to it, it can be taken from them. And so getting out there and having pictures taken and documenting the fact that he was there is important. When these kind of confrontations happen, for the Palestinian to file a complaint pointing out that his agricultural work was interrupted by these settlers can provide that kind of documentation and creates a paper record of the fact that these settlers were on his land. In order to do that, he has to go the way this scenario will run, the settlers will come, and then the settler security guard will come, and then the Israeli military will come, and the border police will come, and like about five branches of this Israeli military with different uniforms and different things on their shoulders and different things on their hats and different cars will show up. And in the end, he'll probably be pushed back some, but he can then file a complaint stating that his sheep were not able to graze that day. But in order to do that, you'd think with all that military there, he could just do that. But no, he'll have to go then. This guy with sniper written on the back of him there, he's from Ohio. And these two, the guys in green are military, and the guy in blue is a settler. So you'll have to go to an Israeli police station in an Israeli settlement. And he'll probably have to do that. The first time he goes, there won't be anybody there to take his complaint. And the second time he goes, there will be somebody there, but not the right person. And the third time he goes, they won't have that form. And the fourth time he goes, they will have lost record of the last two times he was there, and he'll have to start all over again. And every time he does that, he'll have to walk through a settlement to get there. So I personally went and did this one day. I had been kind of pushed around and had a video camera stolen. Mm-hmm. And I and another woman had been on our way because kids had come and told us that the settlers were attacking women in Magayar al-Abid, which is another village near Cuba, where some of those kids are from. And the settlers that had attacked people there when they saw us coming thought that we had been doing our job a lot better than we actually had. They thought that we had them on video, and actually we didn't. But they had broken the arm of a woman who was 8 months pregnant in the village and chased a number of other people away. She just hadn't been able to run fast enough. So we spent an entire day sitting in this police station trying to file this complaint. I thought we were going to be deported. And
we were left, I mean, they timed it so that we were left, you know, they kicked us out of there at the end of the day in the middle of the Kiryat Arba settlement inside Hebron, where, like, it's a very dangerous situation for us to be there. And it was Shabbat then. It was like we had to drive out of there at a time when you're very obvious driving. And it was like they did absolutely everything possible to make this very difficult. And we were an Italian and an American, for heaven's sake. You know, it's like you just think, just imagine doing this as a Palestinian. Just imagine the woman whose arm was broken. She wanted us to go and do this because she was going to also try to file a complaint, and she wanted all this paperwork. But the thought of her going through that was just beyond me. I just can't imagine.
Did you speak to Mr. Sniper?
Yes, I did speak to Mr. Sniper. Mr. Sniper called me a Nazi.
A Nazi.
Oh, a Nazi?
A Nazi?
What? So this is an example of the multiple layers of authority there, and the blue is it's really police.
Is it one of the
The guy with the hat there is the
he's the same.
He's the cell. I guess that's the same guy. That man is actually from South Africa.
Huh. And what is the sniper's role there? I don't quite understand. Assuming what role?
He's just a
soldier. Right?
A soldier who is.
It's probably just a nickname.
Was written that on the back of his flak jacket. Yeah.
But does he work for someone?
Yeah,
he's in the military, and Israel has conscription, so these soldiers are not necessarily there because they want to be there. But there is some overlap between soldiers and settlers. Settlers are exempt from conscription, but they're allowed to serve in the military. And so there's some more mixing than there probably are. So this is some more of this effort too. That's the piece of paper that he has there is an actual deed to land. But you can imagine how hard it is to actually have a deed to land that your family has owned for 900 years. And your home has been demolished 5 times in the last 10 years, and you have this piece of paper.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It looks very fresh.
So that's how this has happened. That's how this land loss has occurred.
Are these your pictures?
Yeah, right. And so that's another thing. This is like, these people live here 365 days a year. I'm there for a couple of months and come away with like more incidents than I can possibly cram into this. Yeah, this is just like if you threw a bunch of days through a sieve, and this is just what caught. So his sheep there has been shot, actually, by settlers. And
what will happen in a case like this?
They took away the sheep. There were actually 2 sheep that were shot and 1 goat. And the Israeli police took all of them, which is a real loss to Shadi, the man whose sheep it was. So they loaded them into a police van and took them away, and he was never compensated for that.
So that'll teach him not to report things.
This is another incident. This goat was kicked in the face by soldiers. And this is an ewe that was kicked, and you can see the it's kind of down below the thing, but she's bleeding instead of lactating. And so then her what do you call those lambs? So then you think, so how do people go out all day with these sheep? There are these cistern wells that are ancient. They're kind of designed to catch water during the season when it rains and snows, and if little, rocks have been moved, a little bit of masonry done so that water runs down into these cistern wells. And the wells are vital for the ability to graze sheep, because otherwise you get them too far from home and you can't get them all the way back to water them in the middle of the day, or the people who are also out all day in the sun. So settlers have poisoned those wells. They've dropped feces and dead chickens and various types of things. And then there's one near to this one actually, with the new concrete there. These olive trees are very, in that earlier picture where you saw the guy with the sheep kind of just below the settlement trees, this is that olive grove. This one was completely rebuilt after being poisoned with help from the UN, who came and tested the water and helped with bringing in the materials to rebuild that. It's just, you know, you saw that road. Can you imagine getting concrete and rebar and a truck of water and plaster and all of that stuff in to rebuild those wells? They're big. I mean, so this was a day when villagers from Tuwani and a couple of other villages had all gotten together to graze on land where people were being very much harassed. And these are the guy standing on the well there and the guy holding the dog are settlers that have come, brought this dog to try to chase people away. And they managed to get the dog to pee up on that well. Oh. And this is also, dogs are considered pretty filthy in that culture. So that also during that day, that dog bit a Palestinian woman who tripped and fell. And the settlers' dogs are very scary. But this is the shepherdess sat down on that well. And that these, you can see off to the left, the young settlers that are just these people, their ability to sit down when those people around is so amazing to me. Just very impressive. The guy on the right is Art Eichmann, who's a lot of people know about him. He's active with the Israeli peace movement and just an amazing guy. And I guess you can't see people are out of the picture, but this was also a day when a lot of Israeli peace activists had come to be present also. And it's, I think that's, I don't know how representative of other areas that is, but that's something that these villages have really done a lot of work around, that building ties with peace activists in Israel. And it's not an easy thing to do because travel is so difficult and communication is difficult.
How many of the villagers speak Hebrew?
A lot of them.
Mm-hmm. How is it that you're able to take all these photos? I would think they would take your camera.
Yeah, I actually did have one camera taken by soldiers once, and I've just actually, what I do with my camera then is stick the camera in my shirt. I've never actually had it like ripped out of my shirt. So. But I lost this video camera. So yeah, it happens. Yeah, I also, I'm not a good photographer. And I don't have there's no point in taking a wonderful camera there because things, even if nothing major happens to it, it's just a horrible climate. It's dusty and dirty. But I take hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pictures. And I think that's kind of what they teach you how to take human rights pictures. That's what they teach you to do. Just keep taking them and then go through them before you forget where you were and what you were doing. And some of them will be useful.
Phone camera would probably be useful for this sort of thing.
Yeah, that day where the dog was there, there was a Palestinian had a camera on his phone, and he actually had pictures of the dog attacking the woman, and then the settlers attacked him and broke two ribs and destroyed the phone and the camera. So that was horrible. Yeah. It.
Sandra, are you seeing more buttons?
I would say that it's worse. It's definitely worse every year.
You were here a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Sharing it up here anymore.
Right. Yeah, I think that it does get worse myself. I think that the settlers are more and more secure every year. They're more like they're more confident every year, I think.
But aren't they scared about Obama saying you can't build more settlements?
Mm-hmm. No, they're really outraged with Obama. They have, they've built a settlement and named it for him. They like their, So this is a poison that was left for sheep to eat, and there have been a number of incidents where sheep have been poisoned. Let's see, there's corn. Corn doesn't grow there. So. This is a field just below the settlement. This was a, not this year, I guess this was the year before. Not this spring, but the previous spring was a drier spring. But this is, for one thing, just imagine this field. Like, nobody in Wisconsin would mess with a field with so many rocks in it.
Yeah.
Just incredible that you managed to plant anything in there. And then to have to harvest it, you know, when it comes time to harvest it, they've got to harvest it in a hurry because those settlers will come and destroy that crop. This is the inside of a taboon oven, and that's bread is made out of that. That wheat is ground and milled and whatever else is done to it, and then baked and eaten all right there. So this oven is, there's a fire under there that's kept going pretty much continuously, so it's always hot in there, and then it's like kind of hollowed out inside there, and those stones are really, really hot. So. And I know that this is this relevant, but you know, it is like, to me, the most important thing is to just see these people as these are real people. This is the, and people say, so is there any nonviolent resistance in Palestine? Like, look at this. This woman gets up at 6 every morning and she makes this bread and she intends for those kids to eat it and go to school. It's just amazing to me. There, her husband, the father of these two kids, is in jail now. He's a leader of the nonviolent resistance in that village and was arrested, or not arrested, detained in early July. Hasn't been charged with anything and is still being.
Was that the picture we saw with the blood on his forehead?
No, it's a different guy. And this woman, her name is Kifa. She's very active with the women in Tuwani have formed a collective to sell needlecraft and various arts. And it's kind of an offshoot of all of the troubles that they've had is that there also have been a lot of Israeli peace activists that have come through, including a couple of women who have really forged a relationship with those women and managed to market their handicrafts outside the village. So right now, I think that the Women's Craft Collective probably brings in more money than anything else into the village. And unemployment in this part of the West Bank is just, like, it's probably 80%, I think. Very few people are working. And so they have been able to fund, you know, like, getting a doctor to come into the clinic once a week and stuff like that. So this is them harvesting at the end of the day. And you can see these terraces there used to all be full of olive trees. The settlers cut down.
Hmm. When you say they're unemployed, but I thought they were farmers.
Well, right, but I mean, my neighbors are farmers, and most of them have a job too. You know, somebody, but no more. You know, this little guy is, his name is Majdi, and he's a very, he's pretending to be a donkey. So these nifty little kind of related to peas kind of things that you pick and eat. They're like we're eating popcorn. They're sort of a treat like that. This is the mosque in Otwani. This is the third mosque. There's been a couple of them demolished, and this one, there's a demolition order for this one now. It's not possible to get a building permit. So villagers have built anyway. This is a great source of stress that at some point it's an eventuality that the military will come with a bulldozer and try to destroy that mosque. And I think that that's like a big worry for everyone, that's going to be really pushing it. And how people will react is very, but I have several times when I've been there, when there have been demolitions in the, you know, elsewhere in the area, home demolitions in other villages, and couple months ago, there were a couple of small homes on the edge of Tumwani destroyed. The entire village, well, all of the men of the village, come and sit on the roof of that village.
With caterpillar and bulldozers.
Hyundai.
Came forward, I guess.
Hyundai bulldozers. Oh, yes. I was surprised to see that.
Well, is it illegal to be Muslim?
No, it's just they're not allowed to build buildings. They can't get a permit. They don't give them permits. So, so then they say you didn't have a permit. So.
So this is happening. This is basically in the yard of the Rabai family. The little, you can see it. Yeah, very amazing. So these settlers have come out, and then. There were, this particular day, there were kids playing soccer on this land. And the man with his back to us, his name is Juma Rabai. He has lost this land personally. Like, he was the owner of this land where we're standing now, and where the edge of those trees is. And it's his kids that we're playing here, you know. And, so settlers have come out and they've and brought these dogs, which are scary. And then the settlers call the military and say that, well, we're out here and the Palestinians have come out. Well, the Palestinians live there, but anyway, then the military arrives. Military is very close because they're now here all the time because of the school patrol, so they do get here quicker. So.
Are the military always that well-armed?
Yeah, yeah. And this is a group of well-armed settlers.
Well,
and they're into this. Like, what is with this green tape on their heads? I have no idea. The guy in the hat here, in the kind of, like, floppy hat, is the guy who was teaching the kids to move.
He's American?
I don't know, actually. Uh-huh. I don't know.
Did you ever have any kind of pleasant or neutral interchange with a settler?
Actually, not any length of time. I have one time was with a family that was harvesting in that area below the trees, and the whole family was out there, there were kids out there, and a little settler girl wandered down, like, saw kids, wanted to play. This girl was maybe like 4. And it was, people were so frightened because the potential for catastrophe there was huge. This little settler girl, I mean, like, she just wandered away from home, you know, it's like, but even as, I mean, even for us, you know, your kid wanders away and goes a half a block, you're going to panic. What's more, she goes into the, you know, amongst these people that you have been taught to believe are going to, I don't know, roast her over coals or something, you know. And so a couple of internationals actually carried her back toward the settlement, like hoping all the while that, like, no one would misconstrue seeing us with her, you know, or think that we had stolen her or who knows what, you know. And we did encounter somebody who apparently was looking for her and looked absolutely panicked and confused and just so I didn't actually talk with that person, but it was sort of a human moment anyway that you could see, right? I once lost track of my son for like 2.3 minutes at the state fair, and I thought I was going to die, you know? I really thought, and I saw that look, just exactly that look on this person's face. And so, yeah.
Was she faithful? Was she?
You know, all we could think of doing was getting out of there.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. I don't know. Yes, I'm sure they were. I'm sure they were thankful. And Juma Rabai himself says he believes he'll see a day when the grandchildren of these settlers will play with his grandchildren. But since the guy already has grandchildren, I don't know what he's thinking.
That guy has grandchildren.
Juma, yeah. People have kids, lots of kids. Uh-huh. Early and always, a lot of kids. I think it's the Pete Seeger approach, you know, and just we'll just wait here until we outnumber. This was kids had been playing soccer, and settlers had come out to harass them and had also taken the soccer ball. And they, the kids were insisting, now that the military was there, that, the, that they get their soccer ball back. And the kids were really, really, really insistent, and they had enlisted the grandmothers in there.
Did they get it?
So you can see these kids. It's just, these kids are phenomenal, you know? It's like,
Now, the soldier looks to be African American, or African something.
Yeah, I think that he's Druze.
Oh.
This is not a plum assignment here. No one really wants to be in the South Hebron Hills or in Hebron. People don't, people within the military don't particularly want to be dealing with these settlers, who a lot of them see as just difficult, difficult to cope with. I talked one time with a man who, there's actually a lot of organization in Israel of people who are former military, people who are trying to, this is a group called Combatants for Peace. And so they're both Palestinian and Israeli former combatants that are committed to, I don't know, whatever, trying to end the occupation, I guess. And so this, I had wound up, we had gone to an action with them and then with several people from Tuwani, and then we were trying to kind of sneak these people from Tuwani back to Tuwani without, because then by the end of this other demonstration there was a lot of military. It was another village had hooked up some solar panels and sort of used the occasion to invite a lot of people. And so we were getting a ride back on this bus with all of these Israeli former combatants. And this guy was telling us that, I had asked him, so like the soldiers that we deal with are always so grouchy and unhappy and won't have a conversation with you, and they're so furious at us with being here, and like, is that really, you know, what's up with that? And he said, well, and I asked him, well, is everybody like that, or is that somehow or other, is that happening just in this area? He said that they have a lot of trouble in the Israeli military with people refusing orders. It's a major problem. And during training, they kind of figure out if you're a risk for refusing orders. And if you seem like you're likely to refuse orders, they don't send you to the South Hebron. So in a way, it self-selects. It's that what they wind up with down there are people who are willing to do this.
I think the Druzes are the only type of Arab Israelis that are permitted to serve in the Israeli military.
Oh, Druze are Arabs? It's
a, well, they're natives in the Arab.
They're natives.
Druids.
So these are, there's another picture of these women sitting down like this, which I find so impressive. And this confrontation, this particular confrontation went on for hours.
Is that young woman with no hijab on, is she an international?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Loading rubber bullets into
her. I read somewhere that in the field manual of the Israeli army, that they're only supposed to use rubber bullets, and they're only supposed to shoot below the knee, but they don't do that. And I don't know, they don't seem to do anything about it.
No, and also, there's nothing harmless about a rubber bullet.
No.
Well, not soft rubber.
Well, the bullets in rubber, wasn't it? I remember looking at it in the
movie.
So this is this relationship between the settlers and the soldiers that is so much a part of the problem there, that these soldiers are the only recourse. They're the law here. If there's a problem, if you're a resident of Tuwani and the settlers assault you, who are you going to call? This is the only person you can call. You can call the Israeli military. You can call Israeli law enforcement. That's all the law enforcement there is. And that's the face of Israeli law enforcement. And that's your attacker. So this is the olive harvest, which I just put these in here because the olive harvest is great, and the olive oil is great. And also, like a lot of sort of life in this village is very hands-on, like that. Not a lot of mechanized stuff.
I heard that the Israelis have destroyed over a million olive trees.
Yeah, this would be one of those. It was one of 50 that were bulldozed that entire field. This field is kind of between Tuwani and the settlement of Abigail, which is maybe a 15-minute walk from Tuwani. And these olive trees were bulldozed because they presumably presented a threat to the settlement of Abigail, which you can't actually see from where the olive trees are there. But they had been bulldozed before. They were maybe about 4 or 5 years old, I guess. Mm-hmm. But they had been replanted and now have been killed again. That same day also this cistern was destroyed. And this cistern is permanently, it's like beyond, not possible to rebuild it.
What is the goal of all this harassment ultimately? Is that they think that they'll finally move to Jordan or something?
Yeah. Right. See, I don't know, if I ever could have a civil conversation with somebody who had an opinion about that, I'd know more. But it sure feels when you're there like the point is to make you go away.
Well, I know the religious groups believe that they're entitled by the Bible to have all the West Bank.
Right, that's right, that religious extremist mentality. But there's also the fact that I think that calmer minds also want all that land. So this picture cracks me up because these little cages that are around those olive trees have been used and beat up and reused so many times that the trees are almost holding up the cages. This same day, the bulldozers then went to, there were no homes destroyed in Tuwani that day, but this family in a nearby village. And these are villages it's not possible to have permits for these homes because the homes have been there for so long. Some of them are cave homes that have been, you know, they way predate Israel. So they were able to negotiate to be able to remove some rubble that day, but the military said that they would stay and watch, and if they saw anybody doing any rebuilding, they would not be allowed to. The guy who's bent over there in the plaid shirt, it's his home.
His what?
His home.
And both. That's you?
Yeah, that is me. So you can see him in the shirt there. It's like, so you'd think you could have, you know, if somebody has come and wrecked your house with a bulldozer, that you'd have someone between you and them. You know, and it was the Israeli military, it was the same uniform. It may not have been the same individual soldier, but it was the same unit, the same military unit that was driving the bulldozer that destroyed the houses. And there he is having to try to negotiate for the opportunity to move enough stones away to be able to get back into that house to at least get possessions, because they weren't given any notice when the bulldozer came. Well, I guess the military's argument is that they've all been told that the villages are illegal and they have to leave. But because people have lived in those villages for 900 years, they don't see it that way. So this is the, after like a long day of moving those rocks, they've got that somewhat cleared out. And this the little kid there is still standing on several feet of rubble that's sitting in a stairwell.
Cassandra, why did they declare it illegal? I mean, was it declared Israeli state land or what?
No, it's just demolition orders have been issued for individual dwellings. And there's nothing there. There's not, it's not like they're right next to a settlement.
What's their reason for it? What kind of reasoning did they give for the demolition order?
They don't.
And the government
sounds Kafkaesque.
Yeah. So the Red Cross had brought this, these huge miles and miles and miles of this white plastic, like tarp sort of stuff.
Where they get the
women were. I don't know where the Red Cross gets that from. White Plastic Central somewhere. It's like the stuff you'd use to cover up lumber with. So they're sewing tents. And by evening, they'll be in those tents. And these are homes. This is the village of Karuba, which was abandoned. It's so beautiful. Just these homes are just, after the occupation, I want to go there.
And you're going to keep going back?
I hope so. I think this is it.
Wow.
Sometimes in the spring, these poppy stories. I guess there is the theory that those are the lilies of the field, is actually those poppies. Very, very pretty. People keep doves. Like they'll make some nest boxes for them. I guess they then eat some of them too. But there are a lot of them around. So I think that's it. Thank you.
Wow.
It's a great team.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for watching and your patience.
It was a wonderful presentation. Will you come back if you know again when you come and give us the updates?
Absolutely. Sure. Yeah. You also, CBT has a website that has, the team there probably is, you crank out 3 or 4 news releases a week. There are events continually, and all of that stuff is available on that website.
That's Christian Peacemaker Team.
CBT.org.